Yeah, hi there. Today I'm here with Dex Red. He is the founder and maintainer of SST, the serverless stack, and also opencoach.ai. I'm super excited to talk to you. How's it going, Dex?
Good. It is super hot here. Our air conditioning is having trouble keeping up, but other than that, I'm doing great.
Yeah, perfect. So for those who don't know you, could you briefly explain what you're working on?
Yeah, so for the past 4 or 5 years or so, I've been in the open source space. My primary project is something called SST. We help people, the framework that helps people ship applications to the cloud, like AWS, Cloudflare, etc. It's an infrastructure as code framework. From that time, I've been doing a lot of open source work. Over the past couple months, we've been working on a new project called OpenCode, which is a terminal-based AI coding tool. Very similar to Claude Code with a few major differences. But yeah, that's roughly my background or what I work on, at least.
Oh, and meanwhile, I guess you sold some coffee over the terminal?
Oh, yes. I forgot about that. Yeah, I also, with a few friends, we have this company called Terminal, which is a coffee shop where you can buy coffee, not made coffee, like beans, coffee beans. And there's no website. Well, there is a website, but you can't actually buy on the website. It just instructs you to open your terminal, shterminal.shop, and you get a UI. I would argue a pretty good UI compared to most e-commerce sites where you can buy coffee, put your payment info, check out. In that time, we were just getting really deeply into what's possible in the terminal. So working on open code has kind of been a natural fit.
Yeah, I tried it. Unfortunately, you don't ship outside the US.
Yeah.
But the UX is pretty straightforward. It's really responsive. I probably cannot get my hand on some back, but that's fine. Because like in my hometown, there happens to be the oldest coffee roaster of the country. They don't ship via SSH yet, so I guess best they can do is Telnet because they are that old. Okay, anyway, can we talk about SST? You mentioned it. It's a infrastructure as code tool. And my feeling is that there are so many of them. Like we have the cloud providers own stuff like Bicep or CDK on AWS. And then we have Terraform, we have Pulumi. So what is SST? Which problem are you trying to solve there?
Yeah. So you know what's crazier? Some of the cloud providers have multiple. So AWS has CDK, like you mentioned, but they also have CloudFormation. They also have these other smaller ones that they spun off, like SAM. Mm-hmm. So I think the root idea, which I would probably give credit to Terraform for really pioneering and having it take off, is the idea that when you're managing infrastructure, it gets pretty complicated. Having a declarative way to describe your infrastructure and make changes to it the same way you make changes to code and have it be applied, it's a really powerful concept. I would say even to this day, those tools are still primarily adopted by people that are managing a lot of infrastructure. So imagine DevOps teams at large organizations, people that manage infrastructure full time. Mm-hmm. That's really who these tools have been popular with. Our idea is that they should be a lot more popular with basically everyone. Like if you're a software engineer that builds applications in like modern day, you should do a little bit of infrastructure. More and more, it's not so much your application just exists on its own and then you throw it over to someone to deploy it. Integrating deeply into the infrastructure you're using has a lot of benefits. If I have some work I need to do that's queued, I should just be able to spin up, you know, an SQS queue or whatever and have that all wired up. So that separation of like DevOps teams deploy it, application teams develop it, it's just been eroding more and more. So the idea with SST is let's take those same ideas, like all the good ideas that are infrastructure as code, but package it in a way that makes a lot more sense for application developers to start with. Mm-hmm. So higher level concepts, we spent a lot of time digging into AWS, digging into Cloudflare, figuring out kind of the best ways to do the common things you need to do. So that, you know, if you're new to this stuff, you can come in and get something deployed pretty quickly while still retaining the ability to dig down and customize everything. That's the other side of this. You know, there's a lot of tools that simplify infrastructure, usually as a hosted product. But as your product evolves, as your company evolves, you just end up needing weird specific customizations. Mm-hmm. So with us, because we're not like a hosted product wrapping something, we're just a tool to orchestrate the raw infrastructure. You can still eventually dig down into those details as you get better with this stuff. So you'll see people start using SST without knowing much about infrastructure, and then 6 months down the road, they're pretty good with AWS. They've learned quite a bit just through using the framework.
So from what I understand, it's basically like aggregating cloud primitives to like bigger building blocks so that you don't have to go down the nitty-gritty of the details of the AWS stuff, right?
Yeah, so that's definitely a part of it, like our high-level components. I think the ones that are really popular, front-end frameworks have just gotten really complex to deploy. They used to just be a set of static files you can throw into a bucket, but now they have deep integrations with some of the compute that's available in these cloud providers, the CDNs, you know, figuring out which routes should go to something that was built at build time versus something sending to be computed dynamically. So wiring all that right is basically impossible unless you're like an expert and you're going to spend a lot of time learning that stuff. So I think those components for deploying the various popular frameworks tend to be pretty popular.
Okay. And I guess the other part is like linking so that you have your cloud resources, let's say an S3 bucket or an RDS database, directly available in your code without having to deal with complex sets of environment variables and stuff, because that's something that SST does for me, right?
Yeah. So, and this speaks to a little bit about what I was saying earlier about building a framework for application developers. You know, in the past, if you were just kind of throwing this over to the DevOps team, you would probably have like 100 environment variables that would be something that those teams filled in. And it's kind of annoying because like it's like this untyped, like random bag of configuration. So ST puts in a bunch of work to give you tools to say, okay, I've created a queue. Now I need to access it from in my runtime code. We make it easy to link those two things together and generate the right types and have decent type safety. So that's probably one of the few features that SST really has. Like if you think about like low level primitives, it's mostly infrastructure as code plus linking plus a dev mode.
That's really helpful. Question is the world ready for that? And what I mean by that is we had serverless. I mean, the whole idea of serverless is give me your code and I run it. We had that like 20 years ago with PHP. Like you give your index PHP file and an FTP server. And then the cloud came because requirements increased and team sizes increased and stuff. So what AWS, for example, what they built is like a very, very granular set of primitives or building blocks for a very broad range of applications. And my guess is that enterprise customers who need that granularity might stick with AWS because they have one invoice. They don't need to trust a third party. And those smaller teams, they could just use something like Cloudflare. I mean, they have Wrangler, they have bindings. It's not linking, it's bindings. Basically, they give you access to all of these larger building blocks because there are only so many ways to aggregate those in a meaningful way. So in other words, what's the ideal customer for SST or ideal user?
Yeah, so most of we have a pretty wide range. If you look at the enterprise side, our usage tends to be, so kind of what I was saying earlier, where application developers should do more infrastructure. At a big company, you're not allowed to, right? You're not allowed to like spin up a VPC. There's like a separate team that manages that. But they're kind of landing this hybrid zone where the DevOps teams manage the big important shared pieces of infrastructure. So the networking, maybe even the databases, but then the application developers can, you know, spin up the stuff that their application needs. It could be Lambda functions, containers, queues, things like that. And you would just import the pre-configured VPCs or whatever else you need. And we have like good support for that. And then on the other side, the startup side, but this is kind of an interesting zone. So I would say the bulk of our customers are companies that were founded in the last couple of years, and they started off with SST, and you know, as their company grew, they grew with us. The reason for these companies being on AWS is, like you were saying earlier, big companies, single bill AWS, like it's going to be hard to get them to use anything else. That dynamic also applies when you have those companies as your customers. If your infrastructure is on AWS, your procurement process with them is very easy compared to if mm-hmm. it's somewhere else. You can pretty much check a few boxes and they're good with it. You can go even deeper where you can integrate with AWS Marketplace, so they're billed through Amazon. You can go even deeper and deploy into a dedicated account that's shared with them. So the dominance of AWS basically means that there's a lot of reason to continue to build in it, even though for simpler projects, it is really annoying or maybe feels like overkill. It's just there's like a gravity to them that is pretty hard to escape. We've been doing more stuff with Cloudflare more recently. And like the platform is great, and they have a lot of interesting primitives and it's very useful, but there is like the reality of a headwind. You know, we got a question the other day. So with OpenCode, we built all the back end. I mean, it's like very prototypey right now, but we were using it as an excuse to try out Cloudflare and improve our Cloudflare support. We got a question the other day being like, oh, where is the data hosted? Like where, like, you know, I'm a company and I need to know where it's hosted. And we're like, you know what? We don't even know, because Cloudflare is like, the whole thing is like, you know, region of Earth or whatever.
Yeah.
And if you adopt their like more advanced enterprise tiers, you can pin your data to certain regions. But you know, if it was an AWS data center, we could have literally just told them, oh, it's in this region, and they probably would recognize it and it wouldn't be this question mark, or they might feel skeptical about it.
And that was those like a couple of weeks ago where we found out that something on Cloudflare is actually ending up in Google Cloud.
Yeah. And that's actually something we knew even. So there was like another...
Yeah, they were transparent about that, but I think nobody thought about that in the first place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think there was another dependency like maybe a year or two ago. It wasn't like a widespread outage. It just affected certain customers. And we learned that I forgot what was it, Azure? It was like they had some dependency on some other cloud or some component of it. So yeah, it's just I don't like monopolies, and I hate when consolidation happens, but AWS is just such a crazy lead, and it's not just technical, it's not just the physical data centers. There's just a momentum in the market that is very hard to compete with. They already have all your customers. If you're trying to build new software and you're trying to sell to other businesses, it's likely, you know, AWS has already been there. AWS salespeople have already been there. They probably already have a relationship with AWS. The infrastructure is probably already running on AWS. So it's pretty hard to fight it. Yeah,
got it. But like, speaking of monopolies, like, the whole thing of SST is that it supports multiple clouds. We were talking mm-hmm. a lot about AWS, but in reality, you support basically everything.
Yeah. So we obviously there's like layers to our support. There's raw support, which is you can spin mm-hmm. up resources. It's in some provider. And this includes major providers like AWS, Google Cloud, Cloudflare, et cetera, but also like one-off specialized providers. Like if you're spinning up a database in PlanetScale, you can also do that through SST. And then we have like our higher level support, which is we really spend a lot of time crafting nice components for certain providers. We've only really done that with AWS. We've started to do that with Cloudflare. It's a slowish process because we have to become experts ourselves, which means we have to deploy quite a few applications ourselves before we recognize what patterns we would recommend. And we're going through that process with Cloudflare right now. And we'll probably just eventually do everything. But yeah, it's a bit of work, as you can imagine.
So technically, how do you achieve that? Is there like CDK that you use? Is that Terraform?
Yeah, so the right now the Terraform ecosystem is extremely strong. That's like, there's an asterisk there, because you would imagine when I say that means it's like, I'm saying it's really great. It's not really great. It's okay, but it's the biggest of all the options. So SST basically supports any Terraform provider. I think people, you know, the value of the ecosystem, there's always a question mark to that. Like, if the ecosystem is mostly just okay, is there still value to coupling yourself to it? The thing with infrastructure is it's really sensitive and it's really important. And things change. And it's very hard to maintain good support for these providers across all these changes if you don't have a lot of people spending dedicated time doing that. A quick example is Cloudflare has released brand new APIs in the past year or so. And they had a big update from Terraform. I think it was like version 4 to 5, like their Cloudflare provider 4 to 5. Migrating something like that is insane, because you have these people with infrastructure deployed. The state file has like the state of all the infrastructure in an old format. Now you have this new format. You have to migrate everything. If you miss one thing or make one mistake, something's going to accidentally get deleted in that process, because it's going to see that it's not in the state file or like recreated or something. That thing could be a database. That thing could be something stateful. So I hold the value of the ecosystem pretty high, even if it requires maybe some trade-offs to integrate with it properly. So we support any Terraform provider. We support any Pulumi provider. I have the option of building your own like JavaScript-based resources. We haven't released this yet, but it's in a branch. So yeah, being able to tap into that large ecosystem of people, like professional people maintaining it, is pretty useful.
Okay. So that means under the hood, you're using Pulumi, right?
Yeah. So SST primarily uses Pulumi as the deployment engine.
Which is basically like a programmable Terraform.
Yeah. So there's some confusion around Pulumi and Terraform's relationship. It looks like Pulumi is sitting on top of Terraform. It's actually not. It's like their own from scratch, like infrastructure as code engine. It actually works very differently from Terraform under the hood. The idea is, instead of writing a config file like you do with Terraform, you can use programming languages to like create resources. And what's nice is conditional logic, things like loops, things like it's actually just those two things, like conditional logic and loops. Seems very simple, but like you can obviously compose them into a lot of complex situations. It's a lot easier to represent that using code versus something like Terraform, where they do have like things like loops in Terraform, and it's always been kind of an awkward fit.
I mean, in the end, they're all like inventing a new programming language when they hit
exactly
those boundaries, right?
Yep, exactly. So just letting people use a language that they've already familiar with is powerful. And obviously with our linking feature, because both things are in TypeScript, it starts to feel very natural.
Yeah. Very cool. So what does all of that mean, like for the future of, let's say, in particular, web development? I mean, we've come a long way. Like we had the monolith, we had the highly integrated frameworks, and they got the hate. Then we had microservices in insane Kubernetes landscapes. Now we are all going serverless. What would you say is the best way, or what will be the best way to set up a new project in like 2 years?
To be honest, I have no idea. I think even if you take something like serverless, it's still pretty controversial, despite it being deployed at pretty massive scales and giant companies. People still treat it like it's like a weird scam. And that's fine. Like, you know, people don't want to like that pattern for whatever reason. I think what's been interesting is I think historically the idea of serverless has been, as a cloud provider, I'm going to ask you to program for this very constrained environment. If you do that, I will give you some pretty crazy benefits as an advantage. If you take something like Cloudflare Workers, you know, the code you write is Cloudflare Worker code. It's not just general application code. But in exchange, you get cool things like, you know, the stuff can be distributed globally really easily. It can scale up and down really quickly. There's basically no cold starts. We can bill you only for CPU time, which is, you know, makes a massive impact on all the economics of all this. That's been the offering. And some people have loved it and embraced it. And some people hate it because they're like, I don't like that my code is very tied to this provider. While that's been happening, I think container offerings have gotten very, very good. So if you look at AWS, you have AWS Fargate, which is give me a Docker file and I'll run it. I'll scale up and down.
Yeah.
That's like very similar to like the traditional serverless in terms of some of the benefits. There's things you lose. Like, you know, I went from serverless to Fargate for an application and all these old problems that I forgot about came back again. But it's a nice middle ground, right? Like your code is still very agnostic, but you're deploying it in AWS. Cloudflare's new container offering, similar situation. It's no longer Cloudflare specific code. It's just a Docker file. So I think there's like a practicality to that shape. It's not too extreme on either side. So I'm just going to, I think I'm, that's just going to continue to be the thing that ends up winning. Me personally, I still always start serverless first, just because I've seen how much headache it solves, especially, you know, we juggle a lot of projects. So even if we're paying 20% more than we have to, the fact that I'm not worried about a memory leak and monitoring charts anymore, that's a huge value for us.
Are there any particular frameworks that you use for serverless? I mean, obviously, apart from SST, when you run your own project.
On the application side, we've just really fallen in love with Hono, mostly because despite having, so what I said earlier, you're not programming specifically for the cloud providers. Hono is an interesting solution because you're writing Hono code and Hono has adapters that work in Lambda. You can move it to a container, you can move it to whatever. You move it to Bun, you can move it to Cloudflare Workers. Obviously, there's like some nuances. It's not magic, but we like using that as a common interface for everything we do. And even some of our open source projects build on top of that.
Yeah, I like Hono very much. That's a really cool and helpful project and framework.
Yeah.
So obviously there is something else that will change in the next 2 years for developers. I mean, that's the elephant in the room. It's called AI. I'm not sure if you heard about that. but that's also in a space where you're active, right? Speaking of open code.
Yeah. Yeah. The AI stuff, I mean, kind of bridging from SST, the AI stuff for SST has been very interesting because, you know, if you imagine going to the AWS console and like clicking a bunch of buttons and configuring something, asking an LLM to go do all that, it can, but you know, it's like going to be slow. It's going to struggle. But because so much of our infrastructure is now code and pretty simple code, like LLM, like your infrastructure code should not be that complex. If it's complicated, you're doing something wrong. It should really just be spinning up resources. You're not putting like crazy complex business logic in there, right?
Yeah.
So my immediate experience with LLMs has been, whoa, this is amazing for infrastructure because it understands that it was really well and it can just spit out infrastructure as code for me to like, how do I configure, like, how do I expose my RDS database publicly to this specific IP? There's like six different things you need to set up for that. Yeah. It can spit out code that can do all that. So that was really amazing for
they have integrated assistant in the Pulumi API docs. And that is so cool. It can really answer pretty much every question, no matter how complex it can get.
Yeah. So it's awesome that we've had this data set of, you know, infrastructure documented as code over the past 10 years, because the LLMs have thrived on that.
So then what's the deal with open code now? So how does that fit into the picture?
Yeah, it's kind of funny because we were, it really started from SST because we kept being like, how do we integrate LLMs into the SST developers workflow? And we were thinking about a few different things and nothing was really hitting just right. The root problem is, you know, LLMs are great, but we have no control over when they incorporate new data. We can't tell them, hey, SST V2 is no longer cool, like use V3, and here's examples for V3. You know, if someone goes and tries to use ChatGPT and try to generate SST code, they're not going to have a great experience. Recently, things have changed. Like they've updated their data set and it's gotten a lot better, but there's a period of time where it was bad. And that was hurting our, you know, adoption, because, you know, people for a new product, for a new tool, most developers are used to asking the LLM about it and to generate examples, things like that. or like, how do we preload an LLM that has like information about SST? So we're just kind of exploring that and eventually came across Claude Code. It was kind of the first LLM tool that we all adopted as a team. Mm-hmm. We didn't really like Cursor. It wasn't really our thing. We've been using Tab Complete stuff for a while in our editors. But in terms of like letting an LLM code for you, Claude Code was like, oh, duh, this is the way to do it. But there's a lot about Claude Code that felt limited for us, you know, given our experience with building stuff for the terminal. It's both like the coffee shop is one thing, but an ST dev is also a crazy, has like a crazy terminal multiplexer thing built in. But we know quite a bit about what's possible in there. So yeah, we're like, what if we did a version of this on our own? The LLM part is actually fairly simple. Most of the work is just standard product stuff that, you know, goes around it.
So why is there this obsession with CLI tools? I mean, not from your side, but I think there used to be a time where like using NeoVim and CLI tools was quite niche. And now everyone is loving Claude Code, and there are a lot of other tools in the CLI popping up. So why did that change? What do you think?
Yeah, so I think there's like, I've always said that people like to pretend that software engineering is like very rational, but there's so many trends and like almost fashion that exists in software engineering. So there's, I'll talk about that, but I think there's also a rational side to this. Yeah, I think there was just a coolness factor that showed up. NeoVim started to get more attention. People saw, like, especially with the kind of rise of like Twitch streaming, people were seeing what someone that's good at NeoVim looks like when they're programming. And it looks cool. It looks cool. It looks impressive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think people saw that and like, they were like, I want to try that. And I think there's value. Like, I've been a Vim user for like over a decade now. There's actual value in that. It's not just like, I think people also try to cast it as, oh, it's like really flashy, but it's pointless. There's actual value. So there's like a benefit to learning those tools. But I'll acknowledge there is like a trendy fashion cycle to it that exists. I think there's like a craving for retro stuff right now. And when you're in a terminal, it feels retro. It's still very powerful. It's not like you're limited, but it feels, you know, like a little bit more old school. And I think with some of how software engineers going, where it's, you feel more and more removed from the computer, it's like a nice, it's nice to get that feeling again. The flip side, I'll say, is a rational part. The thing that's interesting about CLI tools, if you think about it in terms of adoption, a CLI tool is a least discriminatory shape of product you can put out there, right? So if you're trying to build a tool that fits into a developer's workflow, a CLI tool can almost always be used across the board. So that's actually, I think, the root reason why Claude Code is blowing up the way it does, because it doesn't ask you to change your editor. You can use whatever editor you like. You don't have to switch to Cursor. You don't have to switch wholesale. Mm. Not saying that, you know, it's not worth switching, but there's just environments where people cannot switch. Like, we talk to companies all the time where they're like, your company's like deeply, deeply integrate their workflow with their editor, which is crazy to me, but they do that, where like, you need to work on this code base. Like, you have to use JetBrains because they've integrated a bunch of stuff into it. But they can use Claude Code alongside, where they can use the CLI tool alongside of it. If they want to run this stuff in CI, like in GitHub Actions, CLI tool works great there. If you're a DevOps person, your work isn't even maybe in the editor so much. It's like in shells, managing servers remotely. A CLI tool works really well there. So I think there's this, the shape of a CLI product is just a shape that pushes towards mass adoption. And I think that's why it's a shape that is, it's working really well, especially at this early stage that we're in right now with all of these tools.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting take. Turns out I learned that Open Code is actually more like a CLI tool. It's actually an API with a CLI tool in the front. I think someone just made fun of it as having like a TypeScript backend and a Golang front end, which sounds crazy, but makes sense if you look into the typing details. What's the plan for the API, or what does the API actually do?
Yeah. So when we sat down and look at what architecture we wanted to do for Open Code, we decided to split it into a client-server model. This isn't that crazy to me because if you look at basically everything in Linux, it's built this way. Like in Linux, if you have a program to manage your audio, that program is just a front end talking to like a daemon that's running the background. If you take something like Docker, Docker is actually a daemon that's running the background and like a CLI client. The benefit of this is, again, going back to this adoption point of view, you can start embedding this in a lot of interesting places. So with OpenCode, there's a core of it, which is the ability to talk to an LM, you know, like LSP integration, formatter integration, supporting all different providers, supporting all different LMs. That is irrelevant to a UI. That's just the core logic of what OpenCode does. The fact that we are shipping it as a 2E is a today thing. That's like the format we're interested in today. But very quickly, we are going to build a desktop app. We have the, like people in the community have already built a mobile app. People in the community have already built a web app. So this client server model is really useful because you can start to embed, you know, AI, which is like just generic intelligence into all these different places. So we want to make sure that you can use OpenCode no matter, you know, what form makes sense for you. And what I think what's also fun is we can play with different UX that makes sense for the different environments. So for mobile, obviously, if we just copy pasted exactly what we did in the 2E, it's probably not a great experience. We can probably build a very nicely mobile specific experience. Frank has just been working on the VS Code extension. We'll probably have a very native VS Code extension experience as well. We're so glad we did the client server model because as time went on, we just had more and more places to use it.
Yeah, so this makes it really, really independent of the editor, right? If I understand that correctly, you're using the LSP integration on the server side of OpenCode, rather than in some VS Code extension or something.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, so that like you have all the functionality no matter where you are, and it even has functionality to if you're running it on your computer, you likely have LSPs installed. It'll discover and use them. But if you're running it in CI, it knows how to fetch the LSPs and install them and do all that. So we want to make just like one tight little binary that can do everything, and then you can run it anywhere.
Yeah, that's so cool. I mean, during the weekend, I stepped on your feet, unfortunately, because I had the VS Code extension. That was just like when I discovered there was that API backend to OpenCode.
Yeah,
I was like, okay, then can I do a VS Code extension, which comes with a whole different set of problems in like developing extensions. But the core of it was quite easy to integrate. It was just open API spec, a bit of LLM, and then you're there. So that was really, really interesting.
Yeah. So the API is definitely immature. Like we need to refine it a bit, and there's some functionality that's not exposed. But it's just like building a really good public API. You know, we have the open API spec. We even generate SDKs that are nice and typed and easy to use. Like yourself, there's just been a bunch of people that have discovered this early and have played with building clients for it. And I think this is another area where if you think about why OpenCode versus, you know, the dozen other projects that kind of exist in this zone, our advantage is that we can spin up open source projects pretty quickly and grow community around it pretty quickly. We are, like, I personally am a NeoVim user. I personally am a Terminal user. I can probably produce a really great 2E experience. You know, Frank uses VS Code and Cursor. He can probably produce a good VS Code experience. No one on the team uses JetBrains. Like, we can probably sit down and, like, try to do a JetBrains integration, but it's probably going to be shitty because we're not really JetBrains users. Someone in the community will eventually show up being like, I'm a diehard JetBrains user. I built this extension, and it's probably going to be better than something that we do. So our goal is really just there's a long tail of all the places it needs to get integrated into. And, you know, because we have a decent sized community, they will do the work of doing all that.
Well, that's the original idea of open source, right? This is just the power of open source, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I thought you mentioned like using AI in your own workflows within the company. makes you or gets you in a position where you could take more risks. So is open code building itself, or how do you use it in your workflow?
Yeah, it's funny because I don't, people always ask this, like, oh, do you use open code to build open code? And the nice answer would be like, oh yeah, totally. Like, you know, I'm using open code to build open code. I do, but not that much. The reality is open code is weird. You know, it's not a standard web app. It's a CLI app that's written in Bun with like a Golang 2E front end, right? It's not the type of thing that LLMs are like, oh, I've seen this before. So that's one reason I don't use open code a ton. The second reason, at least to build open code, the second reason is we're in an early stage of the project. So right now we're laying down like primitives, the patterns that we use, the right ways to do things. This is a very manual process, both just for me to discover what makes sense, but also to actually do the work well. LLMs are not good at this. You know, you would never have a junior engineer design the foundation for your company for the next several years. Yeah. So there, I don't use it as much. But for web apps, for more things that are in a more mature place, we use it a ton. Like, it's kind of how we develop any new feature. We can now try out lots of different ideas before committing to one. So the example I have is I was implementing a CLI command, open code models. It just lists all the models that you have configured. So you can see like, okay, what do I have configured? If you want to pull out values to put in the config, things like that. And I had two ideas for a UI for it, a very simple version and a very complex version. In the past, I would have sat and just thought really hard about which one makes sense and committed to one. But now I just had open code implement both. And it was very obvious to me which one was better. And it was actually the opposite of what I was originally thinking. So this is a totally new workflow where we don't need to think as hard. We can just kind of look at the implementation, like the real life version of it. Of course, it did some things that weren't great. So I went in and I cleaned it up before I actually pushed it.
Absolutely.
But yeah, like just the ability to like actually try and see some of these options massively de-risks everything. You don't have to like be so certain of every decision that you make.
So just from following our conversation, what I get from SST is basically a CLI code or AI agent. I get a serverless framework and all of that is open source. So how do you make money with that?
Yeah, it's fine. People always ask us this. So we actually are a profitable company. We hit break even back in February, I think.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. So that's why we're able to like try things like open code, because we don't have like a clock that's ticking. It's the same as any other company like this. I would probably say HashiCorp is probably the most recent large scale example of a successful company in this format. Majority of your tools are open source. You never want to try to directly monetize them because they're effectively the top of your funnel. It's how people discover you. It's how people use you. If you start to like try to make people pay up there, you're just killing like the whole ecosystem of what you're trying to do. If you look at any big software company, whether open source or not, the reality is you only make your money from enterprise. Like that's where all the money is. So there's really no reason to try to squeeze every single one of your users to pay. Cause even if you're successful, enterprise is going to be like 80% of your revenue anyway. Yeah. So for the enterprise companies that do make it through our funnel, ship something, build something, we do have additional paid products that they typically need to actually, deploy this properly in an enterprise environment. Again, they don't need to. Like, we have plenty of enterprise companies that don't do any of that at all, but there are some benefits to some of these products. So that's going to be our shape for, I mean, that's our shape for SST. That's going to continue to be the shape for everything we do. So with open code, it's actually very boring. Like, the answer to how to make money is pretty boring. So if you take something like, as an individual user, open code, you go, you install it, and you run it for the first time, it walks you through like either logging in with cloud or like setting up an API key, et cetera. And you personally will, you know, go sign up for Anthropic and API key, whatever. In a company environment, this is like not practical. You don't want your thousands of employees like making one-off API keys, and like you don't want to make them make personal accounts with Anthropic. You probably have a single relationship with Anthropic. So you need that to be integrated into some kind of like central service that, you know, they can log in with their company account and it'll issue credentials, stuff like that. So very boring. Just the boring practical realities of deploying this
single sign
into
on.
A bigger company. Yeah, exactly. It's like a, it's a, it's tends to be the thing that enterprises require. But then also things like observability, like being able to see, you know, which one of my developers are like using this a ton, who's not using it as much, being able to share. And we have that share sessions feature, but for an enterprise company that needs to all be self-hosted and run internally. So yeah, once you get enterprise usage, there's just these very boring, straightforward things that they require, and then you charge them for that. And
paperwork
for anyone that's not in that category, there's really no reason to pay us.
Compliance. Yeah. All these things. Yeah, got it. Yeah, thank you. That was really interesting insight. May I ask you about your personal development setup? I mean, you mentioned you're using Arch, you're using NeoVim. So apart from the editor and the operating system, what are the tools that you rely on most?
Yeah, so physically, my setup is I have a desktop PC, which is sitting on my desk. I've had this type of setup for a while because I do like to game occasionally, so I would reboot into Windows so I can. It's also a gaming PC. Probably in the past couple years, I switched all my development work to running on a remote server. So I rent like a really beefy server that's located not far from me. Like it's in Miami. I live in Miami. I think my ping to it is like 9 milliseconds or something. It's pretty close.
That's pretty close.
Yeah, so I open my computer, I start my computer, and I just SSH into it and reattach my TMUX session, which has every single one of my projects running, and I switch between all of them. It's always running. It always has my stuff up. I've pretty much have always been a Linux user. Recently, though, the Apple MacBooks have just become such great hardware devices. Yeah. Nothing comes close in terms of build quality, performance, anything. So I bought the new MacBook Air, and this is such an awesome device because physically it's amazing, it's light, but I still just connect to my remote session. So I can be in the middle of working on something on my desktop. I have like a specific follow-up with my cursor to a specific point. I can get up, grab my laptop, and then go work outside and reattach the same thing instantly, and I'm back in the same context.
Oh, wow, that's an interesting
setup. Losing anything.
You're using VNC for that, or?
No, this is just all through SSH because I do all my development through NeoVim and OpenCode. So it's all just in the terminal. Yeah. Yeah. So it's really powerful. And this MacBook, it literally never runs out of battery because it's not doing anything. It's just a dumb screen for this remote machine, which is extremely powerful. So I love this setup. It's like the happiest I've ever been with my work setup. I think I'm considering simplifying my desktop. I've also switched to like cloud gaming a lot too, where I'm like all in on this remote setup concept. I have this like tablet situation with a controller that just connects remotely to a cloud gaming service or to my desktop here. Now I can just play remotely, and the latency is basically like is gone. It doesn't feel like it's running remotely at all. So really crazy good graphics, but on this nice portable situation. So I'm thinking about taking my desktop and just putting it in the corner and having it plugged into my Switch. So it's like a server basically. And I might get like a Mac Studio or a Mac Mini as my main desktop machine.
That's a pretty nerdy setup. I love it. Very cool.
It's fun. Like I've been really into this remote setup situation. Mostly because I built my own PCs forever, and my logic has always been, oh, this is like cost effective because I can build my own PC. It's cheaper than if I bought it off the shelf. And then if I want to upgrade, I can just upgrade, you know, one part at a time. And I don't... Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But the reality of this is I wait 2 years or 2 or 3 years. I'm like, okay, maybe time to upgrade the CPU. oh, you know, the slot, the socket has changed.
Yeah.
So now the motherboard needs to be updated. Okay, if I'm updating the motherboard, I might as well get the newest RAM. Okay, but then now, like, then, you know, I do all that. It's effectively a new PC at the, yeah, it's a new PC at that point. And then I'm like, okay, now time to upgrade the graphics card. The graphics card now is like 70% of the cost of the whole PC. So it's just
thank
like,
you, NVIDIA.
I don't, it's actually, yeah, it's actually just the money. It's not saving money. It's actually just, I'm losing money to it. So even though renting is more expensive, upgrades are handled for me automatically. So I pay a fixed amount every month for the best CPU. When a new CPU comes out, they just upgrade me to the new CPU and they like make the old CPUs cheaper. So I'm paying just the same amount no matter what. And someone's handling selling the old hardware, repurposing it and all that. So even though I'm paying technically more than I need to, they just handle all that headache for me. So a lot of people, like I made a video on the remote server thing and they're just like, you know, you can save $30 a month if you just build this. I'm like, yeah, I know, but I really don't. And the other thing is like just getting rid of the old stuff, right? I don't want to throw stuff in the trash. I like want to repurpose it or have someone repurpose it. Trying to like list it on eBay and sell it and ship it. Like it's all just really inefficient and slow. So
yeah, got it.
Yeah, at this point I'm just renting everything.
Speaking of remote development, there's also this dev container specification. I mean, it originally came from VS Code. Mm-hmm. Is that something you're using or looking into?
Yeah, someone linked me to that the other day, and I was looking more into it. I think there is this question of, so if you think about the development environment as a concept, you know, forever it's been a good idea to make a development environment programmable so that, mm-hmm. you know, a new developer that joins a team, you're not giving them this giant document of being like, install this and then do this and then set this up.
Yeah.
They can bring it up easily. Like, you know, you have it maintained well. In practice, almost no company has this. Yeah. Like most people, it'll be like semi-automated, but then there's some manual stuff. And for most companies, like, okay, it's not a big deal. We're not hiring a new person every week. You know, we'll deal with it as it happens. Which is fine. Like we're the same. But with AI, now you could be hiring a new person like constantly in a way. It's like, if you want to give the AI a workspace to work in, if you want to spin up 100 of them to do stuff, you do need to make your development environment a little bit more automated. So with open code, the idea was actually the opposite. The idea is everything runs locally because realistically for most people, local is the only place that their development environment works. But I think as remote agents, as running this stuff, you know, off your computer becomes more of a thing, there's a little bit more incentive to set up something like dev containers. So as that happens, yeah, we'll just integrate with whatever makes sense. Even locally, we have this issue of, you know, people want to use Git work tree so they can run up multiple instances of open code doing different things in parallel. And Git work trees is great. It like makes a copy of your code base in a different folder so it can work in an isolated environment, but it's only stuff that's checked in, so
yeah,
it doesn't install your node modules. If you have any code gen steps, those need to be run. So we're already running into issues of being like, we need to give you a way to specify steps on how to bootstrap this code base so work can actually be done. So yeah, we're going to look more into some of that stuff and see what makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, remote development like is increasingly becoming important, I guess, because if you're mm-hmm. talking serverless, then you're basically part of your work is run mm-hmm. remotely, even though you can tunnel it back to your local host or something, but eventually mm-hmm. to make sure it really works on the cloud provider of your choice, it has to be remotely at some point.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And I guess we take that a little bit for granted because obviously with SST, like in dev mode, local development, like very little is running locally. It's like mostly you're getting a copy of everything in the cloud. So we're kind of used to that, but it's still somewhat new for a lot of companies.
Yeah, totally got it. That was really interesting insights. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Yeah, so thanks for having me. It was good.
If people want to reach out to you or explore open code or SST, I think especially with open code, there was some confusion. So where should they go to and check it out?
Yeah, so the safest thing to do is go to opencode.ai. That is our website. It has links to everything else. All of our communication is pretty much done through Twitter, so you can follow me on on X, on X.com.
It's still Twitter, and, right?
Yeah. and yeah, we have a Discord now for Open Code that is pretty active, and we have a good time in there. So that's probably the three places that make sense.
So what's your handle on Twitter or on X?
THDXR. That is my, no one ever remembers it. So you'll probably find me through the Open Code website or something.
Okay. So everything is linked on the Open Code website, opencode.ai.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect.
Yep.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Cool. Yeah. It was good. Thanks for having me.